California has a booming economy, and a lot of people are flocking there for job opportunities. But there are not enough houses being built to accommodate all of these new people. And because now you have so many people vying for so few available homes and apartments, the cost of those homes has been rising at a really fast rate.
People are dying on the streets because of the affordability crisis.
That's Gavin Newsom, the governor of California. And he has a very straightforward plan to fix the state's housing shortage. Build more housing.
We talk about doubling. Doubling's not going to solve the problem. It's going to mitigate it. It won't solve it. Quadrupling will begin to solve it.
Most economists would agree with this idea, right? Supply and demand. If you increase the supply of homes, the price should come down. But building new homes can be very unpopular on the local level because it can lead to more traffic, it can put more strain on city services, and it can affect the character of a city. And ultimately, the decision of how many homes get built in California is not up to the governor. It is up to local city councils. That's who tells developers how many new homes they are allowed to build.
And so Governor Newsom knew that if he wanted more homes, he was going to have to get hundreds of city councils all over the states on board. And many of them were. But he says there was one city that was particularly resistant.
I mean, the city council just saying, no, not interested. They just thumbed their nose at the state.
So Newsom decided to do something drastic. He took that city to court. That's right. The state of California is suing one of its own cities. And that city happens to be my hometown of Huntington Beach, California.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Darius Rafieyan. We're here from The Indicator, Planet Money's short daily podcast about economic ideas, 10 minutes or less every weekday.
Earlier this summer, The Indicator went to California, and we came back with two very different stories. One about the battle over affordable housing, and one about how the very rich are protecting their very expensive houses with private firefighters. We put those stories together here. And, you know, if you like what you hear, you can head over to The Indicator from Planet Money to hear more, wherever you get your podcasts. So, after the break, why the governor of California sued an idyllic, dreamy beach town where one of our producers just happened to have grown up.
This message comes from NPR sponsor E-Trade. Investing your money shouldn't require moving mountains, no matter how much or how little experience you have. E-Trade makes investing simple. Along with great value, they provide the tools and support you need to navigate the markets, all to help your money work hard for you. For more information, visit etrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Securities, LLC. Member SIPC.
Oh, and one more thing. Do not forget to check out Planet Money's weekly email newsletter. That is at npr.org/planetmoneynewsletter. One word. It is a weekly email on everything from why doctors get paid so much to what Wimbledon can tell us about the perks of being a generalist. That is npr.org/planetmoneynewsletter. Now, onto the show. Huntington Beach is a seaside community that is about an hour south of Los Angeles. And it's known as Surf City USA, right, Darius?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is because it has these, like, beautiful, iconic, kind of golden beaches.
They're beautiful beaches.
They are beautiful beaches.
It's a nice place to grow up. And the legal battle that is currently roiling this idyllic beach city, it centers on one street, Edinger Avenue, which happens to be the street that I grew up on.
This is getting weird, Darius.
It's weird, right?
it's so weird. It's my town
on my block, and now it's at the center of this lawsuit that could determine the future of housing policy for the entire state of California. And I wanted to get a sense of what this means for the people who actually live there. So I talked to a longtime resident.
My name is Freddie. Last name is Rafieyan, and I am your father.
My dad, he moved to Southern California from Iran 40 years ago, and in that time, he has really learned to embrace the Huntington Beach lifestyle. Like, he can always be found wearing board shorts and a t-shirt with his, like, Maui Jim sunglasses on his forehead.
I love your dad!
He's had an uninterrupted tan since at least 1986.
Really?
Yeah, he's just, like, the ultimate Huntington Beach resident. And we met up at our old apartment on Edinger.
Here we are, good old 610, yep. good old unit 610.
We lived there for 18 years.
And when we first moved to this stretch of Edinger, I just got to paint a picture for you. Like, this was not anything special. I mean, the street was known for, like, the old crumbling shopping mall in the corner that was, like, abandoned. Today, though, it's known for, like, chic open-air lifestyle plazas and luxury apartments with all the amenities. Like, the street has just utterly transformed. And that, all this construction and new development, it really doesn't sit well with my dad.
They should stop. They should leave Huntington Beach the way it is and go do these things other places, other cities. It's not Huntington Beach anymore.
And my dad is not the only person who feels some anxiety about this.
You know, the community likes that Huntington Beach flavor that we all moved here for.
That's Eric Peterson, the mayor of Huntington Beach. He campaigned on a promise to stop the overdevelopment of the city. And since taking office, he has been a vocal opponent of Governor Newsom's housing push.
This thought that there's going to be some central planning up in Sacramento that's going to disseminate how every city and county looks, right? It's not what we want. You're not going to turn us into West LA. You're not going to turn us into the South Bend, anywhere like that.
And Darius, you said you heard this a lot when you were talking to people from Huntington Beach. There was this sense that the state is trying to turn this idyllic little beach community into some kind of bustling metropolis or some sort of anonymous, condo-ridden, outdoor lifestyle nightmare.
Yeah, everyone always talks about, oh, these buildings that are just destroying the character of my beach city.
Yeah.
And you know, the governor, for his part, thinks that these concerns are a little overblown.
I'm not asking for high rises. We're not asking for the impossible. Just increase the supply modestly. Show us you give a damn about the people that are commuting 2-3 hours to come in and work in your restaurants. Show us you give a damn about the kids there that can't afford to buy a home there or even rent a house.
This fight over my town and my block, it actually goes back a few years. Take a listen to this city council meeting from 2015.
We don't need a congested city. We don't need giant buildings.
The previous council sold this city down the river. This is insanity.
We are outraged by that monstrosity that's under construction at Beach and Ellis.
These are your people, Darius.
People get very emotional when it comes to zoning policy and housing development. And at that meeting, the city council voted to put a halt on new development on Edinger Avenue. And that was the moment that set this entire conflict into motion.
So California has this law that's been on the books for 50 years. And the law says that every city has to identify exactly how much housing it needs at every income level and make a plan to build those houses. By limiting the number of new units allowed on your street, Darius, Edinger Avenue, Huntington Beach fell out of compliance with that plan.
For decades, though, that would not have been an issue. I mean, this law has gone largely unenforced for 50 years. Cities have never faced any consequences for not actually building the houses. That changed when Gavin Newsom came into office. He decided he was going to start enforcing this law, and he decided to start with my hometown. We should say, Huntington Beach and the state of California, they've long had an acrimonious relationship. It's a Republican stronghold in a deeply Democratic state, and the two entities have been suing each other back and forth over a whole range of issues for years. Mayor Peterson thinks that this latest legal challenge, it's really more about political retribution than it is about housing policy.
It was strictly him going after Huntington. There are so many cities that aren't compliant, much worse than we are. But he's just targeting us for some reason.
Governor Newsom denies that this lawsuit is politically motivated. And he says all this noise that Huntington Beach is making, that is just them trying to score political points.
My gosh, this is a bit of crocodile tears, with all due respect. They knew exactly what they were doing. They were intentional in what they were doing. They were well aware of the law. Nothing should surprise them about this. I think they're finding excuses.
This fight between these two men, it's going to have real consequences for real people. I mean, remember my dad?
Yeah.
The one who didn't want to see new development
was
on his blog?
Was that a tan since 1986? Yes.
My impeccably well-tanned dad. Well, he doesn't live on that street anymore. In fact, he doesn't live in Huntington Beach anymore. He was forced to move shortly after the mayor's development halt went into effect.
They raised the rent really quick. In about a year and a half, the rent was raised 40% nearly. And it got to a point that I just couldn't afford the rent, so I had to move out of the area.
So this makes sense, right? The city limited the supply of housing in that area. So the supply goes down, price goes up. That's good news if you own in that area. But it's not good news if you're a renter, like my dad.
I practically raised both of my kids here, and I really liked it. It was a nice place, and it's a good city. I love Huntington Beach. I would love to come back and live here. But with the rents going up as much as they are, I don't think I'll ever be able to come back.
So Darius, your dad is a low-income renter who was pushed out of his home by rising prices. He is exactly the kind of person that Governor Newsom has been trying to help with this lawsuit.
Right, but my dad is also a fierce opponent of new building.
Yeah.
Which is hard for me to wrap my head around. How does my dad support a policy that is actively against his own interests?
You would rather have to leave Huntington Beach but keep the city the same way it is rather than be able to live here but see it change.
Yes.
I mean, this is what's so challenging about all of this. I mean, people do not slot neatly into these little categories, pro-development, anti-development, pro-affordability, anti-affordability.
Right, because housing's a huge expense, but it's also really emotional.
It's extremely emotional, and it's where you live is part of your identity, and identity is messy. It's not always rational. It doesn't fit neatly into an economic model.
Kind of like Edinger Avenue?
Exactly. Okay, for our next story, I'm going to head out and hand it off to my fellow producer on The Indicator, Constanza Gallardo.
Hi there.
Hey.
Coming up after the break, why hiring super expensive private firefighters might be a good deal.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Hotwire. Wouldn't it be great to get king crab for the price of imitation crab? Then use Hotwire, the travel site that hides the hotel name so you can get a 4-star hotel at a 2-star price. Book your next trip at Hotwire. All bookings final.
It has already been an eventful summer in politics.
Yeah, between the 2020 debates and the president's battle over immigration, there's a lot going on.
And when there's news you need to know about, the NPR Politics podcast is there to tell you what happened.
Not to mention, we're hitting the road so you can meet all of the 2020 contenders.
Oh, NPR is going to drive me completely crazy.
The NPR Politics podcast.
Subscribe!
For our second story, we head to another part of California to check out the booming business of private firefighters. The private firefighting industry is still pretty new. A lot of the companies are based in California, like Firebreak Protection Systems in Ventura County.
And, you know, these do not look like regular firehouses. There's no, like, big brick building with flags out front or giant red trucks. Firebreak Protection Systems is in a strip mall next to a company that installs skylights.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Come on in.
Thanks. Sorry. Are you Chris?
Inside, okay. There's the spacious office and like half a dozen big, beefy firefighter types sitting at these sort of sleek cubicles looking at computer screens. There's pop music playing in the background.
Chris Brandini owns the place. He's a big guy, very strapping, gray hair and mustache. Deep tan.
I mean, you guys look like firefighters, but then this looks like a nice, like a startup office.
Right. No, it's totally different than what you get. You know, we don't get.
Chris used to sell firefighting equipment to homeowners and insurance companies. Things like sprinkler systems, special flame retardant foam. But then, he says, a couple of insurance companies came to him and said, hey, you know a lot about fires, right? So what if we hire you to fight them?
I said, sure. Sounds like, I mean, why not?
In fact, it's the insurance companies that are really fueling the business of private firefighting teams. They started getting serious about it around 20 years ago, when wildfires started getting worse and development in high-risk fire areas really started taking off.
Karen Bradshaw is a professor of law at Arizona State University. She studies wildfires.
So if you think of the outskirts of, for example, Los Angeles, people who are living in the million-dollar homes tend to be those who are tucked into these beautiful forested enclaves.
Suddenly, insurance companies were seeing their most valuable homes regularly at risk of burning down. So they started hiring their own firefighting teams whose job it would be to specifically protect their homes.
Technically, all these places are covered by like the city or the city, county, right, or whatever. So why do you guys need to exist?
Lack of resources. There couldn't possibly be enough resources to go to every single house.
Chris now has contracts with several insurance companies and about a dozen employees. And they deploy 3 fire trucks.
Which don't really look like fire trucks.
No.
They're kind of small, like an SUV.
Yeah, just like a regular truck.
Yeah, but they're equipped with hoses and a 250-gallon tank of water. And Chris and one of his employees, Ryan Barbie, gave us a little tour of the truck.
So all your equipment's back here, your pack, your helmets.
There's like a laptop like right in your truck where the passenger side would be.
Yep.
And it's like this huge map.
Yep.
So all these little green dots you see on this map are all our houses that we take care of.
Green dots are the ones that you cover?
Oh, there's green, there's yellow. They're different insurance companies.
When a fire breaks out, Chris and his team will get a call over the radio.
That show us exactly where the fire is. Did you just hear that?
What does it say?
This is a vegetation fire.
Okay, this is just coming up on your phone.
Just came up.
This is on an app.
Yeah. Should you hear on rice? Should you hear? He just said it's on rice.
Turns out they didn't need to respond. The fire was already being taken care of. But when they do need to respond, Chris and his team will spring into action, drive up to the area near the fire, find the houses they are responsible for, the green and yellow dots, and do something he calls a hot lap, which involves going around the house and clearing away all the flammable brush and spraying special flame retardant foam around the house.
If the fire comes closer to the house, Chris and his team will fight the fire, sometimes alongside the publicly funded guys, using most of the same equipment firefighters do. Big jacket, helmet, axe, first aid kit.
You know, pocket snacks, man, they get you through the day.
Is that right? Is that like important, the pocket snacks?
Oh yeah, sometimes when you go to a fire, we were 42 hours or something like that. We were out on...
Yeah, we were 42 hours, came home, showered, shaved, slept a couple hours, came back out.
Just like the publicly funded guys. But there is one major difference. If a house is not one of the green or yellow dots on Chris's computer screen, they leave it alone.
Like I said, if the house isn't on my list, I'm not going to go there. It's tough, I think.
Chris is quick to say that the insurance companies have sent them to trailer parks to fight fires there, also to very modest homes. It's not just giant mansions they're protecting. And he says they'll often protect homes in the immediate vicinity of the insured homes because, you know, if those homes catch fire, it threatens the insured home. And he says he and his team have saved a lot of houses.
We figured we'd save somewhere around 21 houses over the last few years.
You have?
Yeah, without it, there would have been millions of dollars less out of their pocket, so...
That would be the pockets of the insurance companies.
Chris won't say exactly how much he gets paid from an insurance company, but he says it's in the tens of thousands of dollars a year, but definitely less than $500,000.
We did get that much out of him.
While that may seem like a lot, insurance companies have clearly decided that it's cost effective for them to hire Chris and his team, especially if they're going to be saving these multi-million dollar mansions.
Karen Bradshaw of Arizona State University says that with more and more pricey homes being built in these high-risk areas next to forests and wilderness, hiring private firefighters is probably going to continue to be cost-effective for insurance companies.
The reason being that wildfire risk is still quite small, and the value of these homes and the number of these homes is really quite large.
Chris says he's already seen his industry grow a lot just in the last couple of years.
I mean, we pulled up to this one house and there was four or five different private agencies sitting there. Everybody's in different houses. It was pretty wild. Never seen that before.
Oh, you're like all the trucks are sitting in front of the houses they're protecting?
Yeah, yeah. So we're rolling up and looking at our houses and there's one of them. And I'm like, where are you guys from? And they're from all over the world.
Were they also all working for insurance companies?
Yes.
But now it's not just the insurance companies. Individuals have started hiring private firefighters too. Chris says last year, when the fires got really bad, they started getting calls every day from people begging them to come protect their homes.
He had no idea what to charge for that service, so he started calling around to other companies.
For 24 hours, it was like $20,000 or $25,000. It was
just for one, for a year or just for the one?
No, for a day. That was a day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was
$25,000 a day.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised because I said, that's a lot.
And this just doesn't sit very well with a lot of people, right? Karen Bradshaw says we have this idea in the U.S. that firefighters are supposed to be publicly funded. They're supposed to work for the people, protect us all equally, not protect an expensive house over a cheap house or, you know, Kanye's mansion before a trailer park.
And it becomes a real question, which I think is true in so many places in American society where the government has historically provided some degree of provision of a public good like education, but over time, perhaps the government provision of that good has diminished. And amidst that, private solutions like private education come up and people become concerned about the differential income effects that result.
And just as in the case with education, having enough money to get a private service instead of the publicly available service can have life-changing effects.
Take Paradise, the lower-income town in Northern California that was burned to the ground by one of the fires last year. Thousands of residents lost their homes. The whole town was basically destroyed. Meanwhile, Kim Kardashian's home was saved, along with her neighbors' homes. She went on Ellen a few days later to talk about it.
We were fortunate enough and blessed enough, we were able to get private firefighters. They saved our home and saved our neighborhood.
The neighborhood as well.
In gratitude for her home being saved, Kim presented Ellen with a giant check for $200,000, made out to California firefighters. These stories were produced by Constanza Gallardo, fact-checked by Emily Lang, and edited by Patty Hirsch. The Planet Money version was produced by Rachel Cohn, Darian Woods, and Cynthia Betubiza. Also, we are looking for an intern. If you're smart, if you're curious, if you have a strange and inexplicable love for economics, you should apply right now. It is a paid internship, and it is in New York, and it's a lot of fun. You get to hang out with us, and we get to hang out with you, so definitely apply. For more daily economic stories like these, search for The Indicator on your podcast app and hit subscribe. The Indicator and Planet Money are productions of NPR. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith. Thanks for listening.